Hey folks, David Chen here. You're about to hear a bonus episode where Kim Renfro and I reflect on season one of House of the Dragon. I do just want to point out that while Kim Renfro and I will only be back intermittently throughout the year on A Cast of Kings podcast, I will be covering TV every week over at the Decoding TV podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Right now we're covering The White Lotus and Andor. We have much more planned for the future, so give Decoding TV a subscribe, won't you, at podcast.decodingtv.com. Thanks so much to everyone who's been listening this season and has made this show a success. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the bonus episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Cast of Kings bonus episode. I'm David Chen here with Kim Renfro. On today's episode of the podcast, we are just going to reflect on the season, pick up a few loose ends that came out as a result of the season finale of House of the Dragon Season 1. Talk about our general thoughts on the season, anything we didn't share last time, and just kind of wrap things up for this season of A Cast of Kings. Kim, let me start by asking you this question. You know, we talked a little bit about how you felt last week wrapping everything up, and I guess I am curious, like, you know, looking back on the season, and any further thoughts beyond what we'd already discussed?
I think in general, I'm just feeling so much more chill compared to like my postseason experiences of most of Game of Thrones. Like, it's been really nice. It feels like we got a nice, like, gentle release from what was a very like exciting, it was a very busy time during the season, but like it went by so fast. And it's kind of nice to like sit in a little bit of like the afterglow of be like, oh, cool. Like we did that not only with like the recap podcast, but with the whole show and kind of like feeling how the fandom was going to be responding again to this new series that was pretty unknown. So, yeah, just overall good vibes heading out of this season, which isn't always the case. So awesome. I appreciate that. How about
you? Well, I should also point out that we got tons of emails of which I forwarded you like almost all of them at acastofkings@gmail.com, just basically from folks such as yourself, such as listeners such as yourselves, talking about how much we added to your lives. And I saw one woman actually made a TikTok that was like about how like we were such a critical part of their Monday routine. Like, you know, they would put on the podcast and like do their makeup and hair and stuff like that, and it was like a key part of their routine, and they're very sad now that it's not happening anymore. Aww. You know, and so I do want to say thank you. You know, something that I have said earlier this season is, hey, hashtag tell people whose work you like that you like their work or whatever. You know, like they're like basically like if you like people's work, you should tell them. Not even just applying it to this podcast, I'm saying in general, because I think it really is important. But people definitely took that advice to heart, and we did get a ton of emails. So thank you so much. I think it means a lot. And it's interesting to hear your perspective, Kim. I think for me, I had a fairly different perspective on a fairly different reaction to the first season, which is like, think about it like I was helping to drive a car, you know? Called The Cast of Kings, and then the car's engine vanished, and it went to a very successful podcast and podcast network. And then it's like, okay, I got to keep driving the car, but there's no engine anymore. And by the way, there's like people who enjoy watching the car. There's other people who are willing to pay for the car to continue going. And I just need to keep the car going somehow. And so you were the engine, basically, Kim, that powered Cast Kings through this season.
You built me in real time as the car was flying down the freeway.
and we got to the end of the season, and at the end, I'm like, oh, thank God the car kept going for that. You know, like, that's kind of, I felt like relief that, like, we made it to the end. And I've obviously already expressed my gratitude many times, and I'm not going to do it again, but I'll just, you know, that's kind of been my experience, is that, like, I'm very proud of what we were able to make. And at the end of the day, I'm like, oh, I can't believe that worked. Cause there are so many things that had to happen for that to work.
For sure.
And between like editing between finding an amazing editor named Kurt.
Yeah. Shout out Kurt.
who did our TikToks and has generated many, many millions of views on the TikToks. And we've gotten so many emails from people who are like, I heard about you from TikTok and, you know, that's why I started listening. And so from finding you, Kim, from you agreeing to do it, to Kurt doing the videos, to, you know, the show being good, the House of the Dragon being good, like all those things needed to line up for this season to go well.
Yeah.
And they all did.
Yeah.
And it was like, at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, I'm extremely grateful for that. And, you know, I think there's also a sense of like, hey, you know, you hit the right number in roulette. Like, don't double down and push all the chips onto that number again. Kind of. Mm. There's a you know, like you and I have spoken about like potentially doing other things on this feed. And we decided like, hey, let's just wait until the next Game of Thrones thing comes around. And it's like, I'm kind of like, yeah, let's not push our luck. Like, let's.
Yeah,
this was great. And like, you know, it's a great thing. And we can do it again when House of Dragons season two comes out. But
yeah, it's like we entered a sprint race with no preparation.
Yes.
And like we did it. And that feels great. But we're not about to like continue running a marathon.
Yeah, now I'll continue going on a marathon. Right, exactly.
So we're giving ourselves
a
little reset. And yeah, I would also just like to reiterate what you said of just thank you to all the people who have been emailing, you know, Twitter DMing, public Twitter praising. It's been incredibly validating, I think, to hear that what we said was so helpful and so part and parcel with people's pleasant experience of the season so far. Because I definitely have a tendency to be like, I feel like it's been great doing this podcast with you because I feel very like relaxed. And the way that I get to talk to you is similar to how I would talk to my friends if they were asking me questions about the show, and relaxing. And I don't always believe that someone would find that interesting other than like my close friends or family or whatever. And now I'm like, oh, right. Like I am able to have these kinds of conversations and bring my full A Song of Ice and Fire, Fire and Blood brain memory bank.
Yeah.
put it to good use, and it's great.
Well, I think this season has shown that, you know, people do want to hear your thoughts. I am super impressed by the way in which Kim expresses herself. Just honestly, like the way you express yourself is like perfectly designed for this. You may take this as an insult, but like it's perfectly designed for TikTok, where and I mean it as a compliment in that you are able to like convey not only interesting factual details, but also like summarize the thematic importance in a very, very quick manner. So, but enough about like the self-complimenting of each other. I do have one other question. Enough of the love fest. I do have one question before we get into kind of some of the bigger topics of this season. Which is like, you have written about Game of Thrones for many years. Like it has the experience of podcasting about it been fundamentally different, because talking with Siddhant Adlaka over on Decoding TV podcast, you know, he has been writing at places like IGN for many years, and he's used to like a certain mode of interaction with people, right? Where if you're writing, you're putting your work out, it's like people interact with you in a certain way. They form a different kind of relationship with you than if you are podcasting. And I'm curious, like, if you've experienced it differently, like, do you get more tweets or emails or whatever of people saying like, hey, great job, or like, then if you were writing, or is the tone different? Like, I'm curious, like, you, I've been podcasting for over a decade, you've just started 3 months ago, and so what has that experience like compared to writing about it?
I think I'm getting a lot more feedback on the podcast directly, probably because it's such a more like personal format for people to be hearing my voice and hear my all of my little intonations and quirks of my personality, I think probably come out a little bit more when I'm talking versus when I'm writing. I have a pretty like consistent voice in my writing. And also, I don't know about you, but before I was actually in the writing business, I wasn't the type of person that paid very close attention to bylines. Like I would know what outlet I was reading, but I wouldn't necessarily notice if I was following the exact same writer.
Yeah.
So I think that that's just the nature of writing articles, is that I'm sure that plenty of I know for a fact, because I have the data, that many people are reading my articles, but I don't know that all of them are always being like, oh, that's a Kim Renfro article. It's just like a cool House of the Dragon article that they've come across or whatever.
Well, whereas, first of all, I mean, one of the aspects of this season is people love the Kim Renfro impressions now. You know, like Multiple people have said, like, the Kim Renfro impressions are what get me through the week, you know? So
I will try and add some of those flourishes more often, but...
Oh, I'm reading a Kim Renfro piece.
I'm reading a Kim Renfro article. It's very fascinating. I'm going to go find this Kim Renfro and tell her. That does happen, and it's amazing when that happens, but I think that it's less likely to happen just by nature of the medium. So that's sort of been the biggest difference, is having people respond to what feels like me personally a little bit more than, like, my articles, which I don't know about. I read things in my own voice in my head. Mm-hmm, yeah, I don't know if you do that either. So it's like there's a separation there.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, enough navel gazing. Let's talk about some of the stuff that actually happened in the season of House of Dragon. So first of all, I want to begin by acknowledging that we got, I don't know, a ton of emails at castkings@gmail.com. People writing in at decodingtv.com, basically saying, David Chen, you are wrong about Rhaenyra and you should feel bad. Your opinions about Rhaenyra are bad and you should feel bad, is kind of the overall tone of them, is my opinion. No, I'm just joking. People were very kind about it. But as an example, Pernicious Ducks writes, so to remind people, I was kind of like, hey, hasn't Rhaenyra been acting recklessly this whole season? And now she's acting super smart. Like, what's up with that? And you were like, I don't think there's any inconsistency. And we got a lot of Kim defenders, basically. Pernicious Ducks writes, the idea that Rhaenyra's relationship with Harwin Strong was reckless baffles me. Otto had put the idea in Allison's head that Rhaenyra would murder her children unless Aegon takes the throne long before a single strong boy existed. It's a giant red herring of an excuse. These kids are as much Targaryen as any of Allison's kids. It's only due to chance that they have brown hair. It fits foot model Allison's holier-than-thou image that Rhaenyra is some sort of harlot running around town doing whatever she wants. But Rhaenyra had to have children with someone to cement her claim to the throne, and that couldn't happen with Laenor. She did everything she could in the show to keep the peace, including offering to marry her son to Helaena, an option I'm sure Helaena would prefer to her current sex-pest husband. But no, Allison decided to push the war by marrying her two kids together, something that if Rhaenyra did, she would condemn as deviant. Or she would be condemned as deviant, I think. The important bit is the reason the realm is in danger has nothing to do with her children having brown hair. It never did. She would be in exactly this situation if those children had platinum blonde hair and slightly browner skin and were 100% Laenor's trueborn sons. The cause for this war is her lack of a penis. There's nothing she could have done to change that, and blaming her affair with the Strongs is some real victim blaming in my book. It reeks of, well, if she wasn't wearing those clothes, she could have prevented this whole thing. Additionally, I want to point out that if this is the sole cause of the dispute, the option is on the table for Rhaenyra to admit that her first three boys are bastards under the condition that they're treated well and named Viserys, her firstborn son with Daemon, to be her heir. That kid is more Targaryen than any of Allison's brood. Problem solved. But as I pointed out, this isn't actually a problem at all. It's a half-hearted excuse to blame the victim, and Rhaenyra has done nothing but try and hold the realm together this entire season, end quote. I mean, I think that's some pretty strong language Pernicious Ducks is using. And let me just be clear. Pernicious Ducks, obviously a supporter of A Cast of Kings, but has hated my opinions about Alicent this whole season. So,
wait, about Alicent or Rhaenyra?
About Alicent, and therefore by extension Rhaenyra, right?
Yeah.
Which is that I find Alicent the more sympathetic character in many ways. Mm-hmm. And Pernicious Ducks, I think, from what I recall, is convinced I'm doing this as a troll, which, you know, very reasonable, but it's not true. It's not true. Like, I actually think that's the case. That said, the most convincing argument I heard is basically, like, Rhaenyra, that was partially reflected in Pernicious Ducks' comment and also in other people's comments, is like, hey, Rhaenyra would have been in an even more compromising situation if she had no kids.
Right.
If she had no kids, like, she would have been completely fucked. And and so, like, that does make a lot of sense to me. But yeah, Kim, I don't know if you have anything to add to this, but
I mean, first of all, thank you so much for everyone backing me up. I love
you love that energy for people.
I love the energy of being validated on the internet. But I still agree with myself and with all the people that wrote it. I do think that, like, you weren't being that hard on her. I think it's...
No, I was not.
It's great that you were able to, come around on this, like, well, if she didn't have children, she would be in even more danger opinion. And yeah, just in general, I think like bigger picture here, we have to remember that like us, the audience, deciding that either Rhaenyra or Alicent, that one of them is behaving more badly, is just sort of playing into the exact division that the men in the fictional men in the show put them in, right? And it's like, I don't think that we're supposed to come away with this thinking that we need to believe that either Alicent or Rhaenyra has acted quote unquote better or like less badly than the other. I think that they've both made mistakes throughout their life, but like Ryan Condal and the showrunners and everyone keeps like making the point that Fire and Blood, the book, this biased history, pitted Rhaenyra and Alicent against one another. And the point of view that the show is trying to tell is that it was not squarely on either of their shoulders that this happened. It was the choices of their fathers that put them in these positions from a very young age. And we're just watching them try and do the best with those circumstances. So, yeah.
I do see this kind of, and I have tried to avoid it, but I can't say I've done an amazing job.
And I haven't either. Like I've been anti-Alicent for different episodes, you know?
Right. Like, go ahead. What are you saying? What are you going to say?
I was going to say like, they are still responsible for their actions. And if they are hurting other people, et cetera, et cetera. But the bastards thing in particular with Rhaenyra didn't ever feel to me like it was coming from a malicious or thoughtless place versus like, a necessary transgression in order to try and ensure that she has some sort of line of succession out of that first marriage. But yeah.
I do think this is a part of fandom these days, though, is it's a key part of fandom that you need to take sides.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, oh, I need to be on so-and-so's side and they need to be super sympathetic and like, and therefore anyone against that person, I am against.
Right.
And I don't think it's healthy. And I'm not saying I have never fallen into it. I probably have many times a season, but it's not healthy. I don't think. And certainly it seems to be direct, as you pointed out, directly against the themes of the show this season. Right. I'm just going to read an interview from Ryan Condal from the New York Times about this. He says, quote, "At its most basic, this story is about these two young women who are really girls. They're 14 when we meet them, who are forced into this political Game of Thrones in the most literal sense by their fathers. Somewhat knowingly, somewhat unknowingly on both sides. Decades down the road, when those seeds are allowed to grow and bloom and Alicent has a son who becomes Rhaenyra's chief rival, what's going to happen then? Is the whole realm going to just say, oh, well, we picked the girl, it should be Rhaenyra? No, this is a patriarchy. This is a problem that values, oh, sorry, this is a place that values male strength and primogeniture. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem. It all goes back to Alicent and Rhaenyra and their fathers. The daughters grew up into adults who've been manipulated and poisoned by their fathers in a world where they're taught, as we talked earlier, about picking sides. They go on to perpetuate this division that began in the pilot. It's all about them and will continue to be," end quote. So, and I'll just say, like, I also see it extend to this podcast, Kim. You know, what I mean by that is, and I talked to you about this, right, where, and podcasts in general, where, like, people often feel like they have to, like, take sides on a podcast for like, literally a podcast and pit co-hosts against each other.
Yeah.
Which I've seen in many times over the course of my career, like, particularly when I complained about the time jumps, like, we got a ton of hate for me and a bunch of praise for Kim and like people basically trying to pit us against each other, which is, which I was honestly concerned about because I haven't worked with, like, for people I've worked with for like 10 years, whatever. They're not going anywhere. Like, it's like we've been working together for so long. You know, who gives a fuck? You and I just started working together. And it's very weird when you start getting like 100 messages being like, David Chen fucking sucks. And like, you know, Kim is smart and Kim, you shouldn't be working with David Chen. It's like, okay, that's really weird to have happen to anyone, like in a working environment where you just started working with someone. And I just wish people should understand that, like, podcasts such as this one are held together very delicately. They're not like, we are not like a massive institution that has lasted for many years. Like, it's just literally two people deciding we want to get together and talk every week.
Yeah.
And if that changes, then it doesn't exist anymore. Like, the podcast just goes away. But people don't think about it like that. And, and it really bothers me, but you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. So,
you know, anyway. It never once occurred to me to sign on a Monday morning and say, David Chen, I received 4 anonymous DMs from strangers who told me that your opinions are wrong, and therefore I shouldn't talk to you anymore because you're wrong. It's, you know, yeah, I find that extremely pointless to say that someone's takes on a show are bad or wrong or invaluable to a conversation when I know for a fact that you're not alone in how you felt about that. You're not the only person in the world who had that reaction to time jumps. And Ryan Condal himself admits that it was an incredibly risky thing to do. I feel like we have talked about that a lot. But my point is that I appreciate you, David Chen, and all of your thoughts and feelings. And even though it's nice to be validated when people agree with me, I'm not like wanting people to tell me that I'm right and you're wrong. Like, that's not...
Right. I just think it's fascinating that, like, and I'm interrogating, like, my own thoughts on it, too. Like what is it that makes me want to take, like, Team Allison's side on it? You know, is there something in me that's like, I must win. Rhaenyra is wrong. I must, like, I do have a contrarian streak within me, personally, you know, as a human being. And so, but yeah, I do see, like, and it's not just my podcast, like, my other podcasts or other podcasts that aren't mine. Like, people often want to, like, be like, so-and-so is great, and so-and-so, like, in the reviews, you read any podcast review, and tons of people are like, so-and-so is great, and so-and-so sucks. And it's like, they want to, like, take sides in the podcast and on TV and in whatever they're consuming. And I just think it's not healthy, and it's not healthy and counterproductive, I think, in general, you know?
Yeah, or like take your side, but like you said, that doesn't automatically mean that everybody who disagrees with you is some sort of an enemy.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
exactly.
You can feel confident and like steadfast in your take and your analysis of the show, and then like listen to other people or not. Like, if you seek that out, great. But then it's like you can't control what other people feel about the show, nor should you want to, because everybody's their own person.
Indeed, it's a whole beautiful tapestry. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that you have that open-mindedness, Kim.
Thanks.
So, New York Times. I was just quoting from an interview with Ryan Condal. Headline of the New York Times article, Ryan Condal was surprised people liked House of the Dragon so quickly. A bunch of little tidbits in this interview, Kim, but the headline is, like, what surprised Ryan Condal? And he says, quote, I was surprised in a happy way about how quickly everyone embraced House of the Dragon. I really thought it was going to be more of a hill to climb. Because we were following the Beatles, and how do you do that? You don't. You don't just try to do your own thing and hope it connects with people. But I was shocked that people came right out the gate and accepted it generally. This massive fandom, tens of millions of people watching the show, writing about it, and talking about it, end quote. It has been remarkable. I mean, just compare like the last 3 months to like 3 months ago to now, when we were about to go into this, we're like, is it going to work?
Yeah.
Maybe? You know, like we were so unsure because people had so many mixed feelings about Game of Thrones when it ended, but... there's no other way to read this season of House of the Dragon as a success of you know, TV making. Like,
yeah,
it was buzzed about, it had amazing ratings, it had amazing moments. Like,
yeah,
they pulled off something very, very challenging, and they need to be praised for that. So,
yeah, absolutely. When I think back to being at the premiere, and how sort of like, how it was like, it was still a great grand event put on by HBO, but it was so much more like intimate and felt kind of more chill compared to like the Game of Thrones seasons. And I was really sitting there being like, huh, maybe Thrones has just like shrunk a little bit. And like, this is just the byproduct of the primary series ending, the pandemic happening. It's so hard to capture everybody's attention now. At the same time, I can't tell you how many frickin' what will the next Game of Thrones like articles, questions, PR pitches have been sent my way in the last 3 years. And it's like, oh, turns out it's the other Game of Thrones show is going to be the next Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
The fact that they were able to recapture that Sunday audience and like, you know, water cooler conversation is a remarkable achievement from them, because I think that they did have a pretty steep hill to climb. And I think that Ryan Condal nailed it from the writing perspective. I think that Miguel Sapochnik did an incredible job from the director's perspective for showrunner here. And yeah, they really just, they put out a great season of television, which was the best case scenario. And not everybody was sure if that was possible. I think a lot of people were kind of sitting in this limbo. So I think it's impressive that they were able, and I understand that surprise too, that they were able to like recapture that energy again. Awesome.
It was
awesome
not at all assured. It was everybody. Not all assured, but awesome work, everyone. Yeah. So he also talks about Damon. There's been a lot of talk about Damon in the last week, right?
Yeah, we and, should get into that.
The question was asked, much of a fandom wants to see Damon wearing a white hat or a black hat to the point that many of them criticize Sarah Hess, an executive producer for the show, for her less than glowing assessment of Damon. Did you see this coming? Okay, so what the interview is referring to there is a piece on The Hollywood Reporter where Sarah Hess is baffled that Damon has become an internet boyfriend. And she said in The Hollywood Reporter, Damon has become an internet boyfriend in a way that baffles me. Not that Matt Smith isn't incredibly charismatic and wonderful, and he's incredible in the role, but Damon himself is, I don't want him to be my boyfriend. I'm a little baffled how they're all like, oh, daddy. And I'm just like, really? How, in what way was he a good partner, father, or brother to anybody? You got me. He ain't Paul Rudd. End quote. Okay. So then Ryan Condal responds, quote, I'm having trouble understanding it. We established right out of the gate in the pilot that Damon is a fascinating guy, but he's not Ned Stark, so I didn't see it coming. To me, Damon is the anti-hero of this story. He's a character with a real darkness to him, who's dangerous and charming in equal parts. I knew people would be fascinated by him and latch onto him, but I figured they'd do it in the same way they did with Jaime Lannister or Bronn or the Red Viper. I did not think they would oddly apply this sort of super fandom to him and try to justify every single thing he's done as being intrinsically heroic. It simply isn't. It's not the case, nor will it be in the future. End quote. I am curious, like, those quotes have come out in the last week, and I'm curious, like, what your reaction was to those. I have thoughts, obviously.
I blame Matt Smith for being too hot.
That does sound like his fault.
At some point, partway through the season, I was texting with a friend and I was like, making Damon sexy was like the only way to pull off this character without having people like hate him entirely. And I think I stand by that. I remember writing in my notes too at the start of the episode where he kills his first wife, being like, oh, there we go. I gotta rein in my affection for Damon at this point. Like, I can forgive him chopping limbs off of supposed criminals or like being a generally insensitive dude, but like wife murdering is a bit harder to come back from in my mind. And so it was interesting that like as the finale unfolded, and like, yeah, I guess like seeing him with Rhaenyra was, I found parts of that romantic or like at least engaging in terms of it's something that Rhaenyra really wanted, and he did seem like he was being a pretty solid partner to her. And then, you know, we talked a lot in our finale episode recap about all the ways that he started to fail her. And then him choking her, like the way that some people were like, oh my God, that's so out of character for Damon, or like, why would they ever write that scene in? I was a little bit surprised to see that reaction from some people. But also I want to say, like, I didn't see a ton of people feeling that. And so, like, even, like, this backlash or whatever against Sarah Hess being referenced in this article, I do feel like it must be a pretty – I feel like it's a minority of the fandom. I think it's, like, a subset of people who are, like, Daemon Targaryen stans and or people who, like, just really didn't want – additional examples of violence against women to be sprinkled into the show, which valid, reacting very strongly to it. But I worry that this is like one of those things where it's like a small slice of the fandom who feels this way, and it's just being amplified because people like to talk about criticism and backlash and fan petitions and stuff. I don't know.
I mean,
what do you think?
That's a fair point about the fan backlash, but I do think it is a fact that people have really latched onto Damon and love him, right?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I love him as a character. I find Matt Smith's performance incredibly compelling. I'm constantly a little bit on edge whenever he's on screen because he has been established as such an unpredictable and violent person that you're always kind of wondering when that side of him might come out. But I remember even way back in the pilot episode, we talked about this, how I kind of clocked from the beginning that they were doing something smart with his character, which is having Damon be very honest and truthful at times when nobody else was. Like when he was speaking to Viserys and saying, like, all of these men around you just are like leeches and you are a weak king. He wasn't wrong. Like, I think that he was, yeah. I think that he was saying something very true in that moment. And it reminds me of like Succession, right? Where you have like these dirtbag characters, but every once in a while they do the right thing or say the right thing. And you get kind of stoked in that moment to see that character kind of ping ponging between like righteousness and childishness. You know, Damon's kind of like a big toddler who can be a man every once in a while. And we love when we see man Damon come out. But when big baby Damon is on display with his violence and his tantrums, it's supposed to be concerning to us. So that felt consistent to me throughout the season.
Yeah, I have no, like, my only concerns with the Damon character as he's shown on screen are around the time jumps. I don't need to reiterate that. Like, yeah.
It's timeless, timeless, sexy Matt Smith.
Well, no, but more just like we fast forwarded past so many parts of his character development that
end,
like my main complaint was like by the end, I don't really know what we're looking at in terms of who this character is. Because 20 years have gone by in this season. So it's like, are you the same person you were 20 years ago, Kim? You know, I don't think so. Right. And so it's like if you miss 20 years of someone's life, you know, like you would not if I fast forwarded you 20 years from now and asked you to tell me what kind of person you are, like, yes. You got glimpses of him throughout the years, but it's just not enough, in my opinion, to form a strong opinion.
No, especially since all of the scene, like we didn't get very much of him in private either.
Exactly.
Compared to all the other characters.
I just said I wouldn't reiterate it and I reiterate it. So I'm sorry about that, but
no, I'm glad you did. Cause it's a good point to keep in mind.
Yeah. But I will say here's my opinion on Matt Smith. He is the most, in my opinion, Damon is the most one of the most effectual people in the show. Let me restate that again. Damon is one of the most effectual people in the show, which is to say, you know, I remember watching the first few episodes with my wife and she's like, this guy's a complete badass. At least he knows what he wants and he's doing what he needs to do to get that. Like, he's one of the only people in the show that's actually doing that. That we see explicitly doing that, you know, and I think that makes him extremely attractive in the show. Who, like, you know, one of the other major characters was like Viserys,
right?
And he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing in most of the show. And and I'm not trying to say the women like Alicent and Rhaenyra were ineffectual, but I do think they were really hindered by their fathers and the patriarchal structures around them. You know, so. Yeah. So I'm not saying like they don't have good independence or self-determination or agency, but like they are operating in a system that is trying to stop them from doing what they want at every turn.
Yeah.
And so to see a character who basically has cast off the constraints of that system and just does whatever the F he wants.
Yeah.
Is inherently attractive in this specific show. In Game of Thrones, we had like multiple characters that kind of did that, right? Like that were kind of like, I'm doing my own thing. Jon Snow, I'm creating my own destiny here, you know, or Daenerys Target, you know, like multiple characters who are kind of doing their own thing. And here, really, it's only Damon, as far as I can tell, or he is one of the only ones. So I'm not saying like Rhaenyra and Alicent didn't make really great decisions that were useful for them, but like just in terms of like Damon being like, I want to do the thing, I did the thing, I don't give an F what anyone else thinks. Yeah. No one else did that more than Damon this season.
Yeah. Damon seems to have truly unlimited agency in a way that Viserys didn't, because he felt so beholden to the realm and to sort of people pleasing all around him. But like Damon's like the free agent who truly just gets done whatever he wants to get done. And it's satisfying to watch that in a character for sure. Yeah. The last thing I'll say about the people who seemed upset by Damon's characterization, particularly in the finale, is that like those quote unquote changes, but I it's like you can't even call it a change from the book, because the book upon which House of the Dragon is based is already this little biased fake history text that's very sparse in detail for different sections. To me, adding in things like, oh, Damon's also a domestic abuser in his relationship, like, to me, that's not on the level of like changes that they made to Jamie's character, or like, you know, one of the classic examples was like the whole disastrous season four bit where like Jamie rapes Cersei next to Joffrey's corpse. And like in the book, that's a much more consensual encounter. And in the show, it wasn't. And that really upset people because like, it was like, oh yeah, let's add one more assault into the show that wasn't present in the books. Yeah. I just think it's kind of apples and oranges with Fire and Blood, because it's like, we don't know a ton about how Daemon behaved on a day-to-day basis based on that book. And in the same way that the show is getting to recontextualize things with Alicent and Rhaenyra in a way that I think is really amazing and successful, they get to do that with Daemon as well. And it's I'm okay with the fact that they're painting Daemon as a much more gray space character than maybe people would prefer. So that's just my two cents on the on the adaptation choices that they've made with Daemon so far in this first season.
Yeah, yeah. There was a hilarious bit where Ryan Condal kind of struck back at some of the people who said, you know, there's people who have like been saying to Ryan Condal, you don't really get who Daemon is, you know, and Ryan Condal basically responded, yeah, okay, you tell me who you tell me and George R. R. Martin more about who Daemon is, okay?
Yeah.
You tell me a person who like has read this book, like has spends all of his waking hours thinking about this book and this show, who Daemon is, okay? Thank you.
Yeah.
He kind of did respond in a separate interview about that that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
But here's the biggest piece of news that dropped in this Ryan Condal interview. Arguably, this is a spoiler, but I don't think so. Question asked. To tell this story, you relied on time jumps in recasting certain roles, Alicent and Rhaenyra most notably. How do you feel that went? And will we see more moves in the future like this? Seems like a big risk to take. To which Ryan Condal responds, yeah, and this is a credit to my partners at HBO being brave enough to say, that's the way we're going to tell this story. There really is no way to tell the story of a generational conflict without spending time with each generation and understanding what happened to make things go bad. But it was very risky. As complex as the original Game of Thrones was, they did not do anything like this. So it was a bold choice. But we were standing on the shoulders of a giant that had done a lot of legwork before us, which allowed us to make that bold choice knowing we had an audience that was going to lean forward and do the hard work of paying attention to the show. They weren't just signing up for empty calories, popcorn entertainment. I'm really glad and proud of and grateful for the audience who buckled up and came along for the ride. The reward for everybody is that the story from here forward happens in real time.
Woo!
End quote. Woo!
No more time jumps.
Woo! We also had news that Casey Bloys confirmed what we had discussed. Casey Bloys from HBO. Executive at HBO confirmed that it's very likely that the next season of House of the Dragon is going to be 2024.
Yeah.
Not impossible that it'll be 2023, but like I don't think it's going to happen, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, the big question for me, Kim Renfro, is like, how are they going to handle the kids? Like, the kids are going to... Are they just going to keep the same kid? Because they will look dramatically different next season already than how they look this season. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know how old the actors are.
Jace, I feel like, is going to look older than he did this season. So I don't know if they're going to do another casting change around that, or maybe they're going to be like, we're sticking with these kids, the last ones you saw. And if they look older, if they look 2 years older, then we'll deal with it then. You know, like, I don't know how they're going to do it. But
yeah, I mean, the littlest kids, they could easily just recast. Like, you know, like Jahara and Jaharis, we only saw like a glimpse of those little blonde twins.
Yeah.
And now that Luke is dead, Jace is probably the youngest. I don't know how old the actors are who played Jace, Bela, and Reyna. I should look that up. But maybe if they're like 17 or 18, maybe they wouldn't look too drastically different if they're filming in the next like 6 to 12 months.
Right. It's true. It's true. But in any case, obviously the big news there is he's saying no more time jumps.
No more time jumps. Yeah, I don't know if it... I know about how many years are left in this Dance of Dragons period, but I don't know if it's spoilery to say that or not. But it makes sense to me that we would stop the time jumps now. Yeah. Yeah. So, sweet.
Any other thoughts? I have, you know, related topic on that, but any other thoughts on this Ryan Condal interview? I thought it's a good interview. I mean, Ryan Condal, I have to say, comes across as like a pretty level-headed person, like very gracious, level-headed creator, in my opinion. You know,
yeah.
I don't know if you, yeah,
I would agree. Something that I've appreciated about him and Miguel Sapochnik throughout the interview process, both when I talk to them and when I've seen write-ups of their previous interviews, is that they seem very ready to have direct conversations about hard topics, about things like assault, about things like showing graphic birth, about things like what it actually means to have a story told from a female perspective and have women be sort of the thematic center of a story in a way that you don't always get from other showrunners. I've read and talked to a lot of showrunners over the years, and a lot of them, you know,
a given that they're going to engage in the way that Ryan Condal has in this season.
Right. Or like the fallback of like, well, we just love having strong female characters. Like, I never want to hear that phrase come out of another person's, because it's like, what does that mean? But they seem, mm-hmm. they seem able to be very direct about the tough themes that they're tackling. And especially like, even like with like the changing of the Velaryons to be a Black family, and like right out the gate, even preseason, I remember there was that quote, I think it was with the Hollywood Reporter, where he was like, oh yeah, well, we didn't want there to just be a bunch of white people on the screen again. And I was like, I don't think I've ever heard a showrunner just say that. Like, oh yeah, there was like, we not like, well, diversity has been so important and like, we want it. It's like, no, just straight up, like, we didn't want another show that's just all white people. Things like that, where I've appreciated their candor and their willingness to kind of have those conversations, be wrong as people are want to be wrong every once in a while, perhaps, and then talk about it. I think it's been nice.
And they're putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak. And what I mean by that is, I think is it the case that House of the Dragon has had certainly an extremely significant number of female directors and writers for this season, right?
Yes. And I believe even at least one cinematographer who was a woman.
Right. Which is like basically in terms of like average number of episodes that feature women in those positions.
Oh, yeah.
House of Dragon probably beats any other season of Game of Thrones, right?
I believe the math was done back when the directors for season 8 were announced and it was going to be all men again. And it was like something like 5% of episodes of Game of Thrones total were directed by women. And that's across 8 seasons. But here in one season, I think that we're up to like 40%.
Right.
Of the episodes already directed by women, not to mention having the first ever I want to call it a byline. It's not a byline, but having an episode that is both directed by a woman and written by a woman, that never happened in Game of Thrones 8 season run.
I don't see much like self backpatting about that on their parts, you know, and I think that's a good approach to take for them.
Right. Cause it should be the norm.
Right, it should be the norm. agreed. But it is good that, it feels to me like a very conscious decision on their part to put women in those positions.
Yes.
I think the show has obviously benefited from it. And so hopefully we see more of that in season 2. So.
And to then back up, like, the way that Ryan Condal backs up Sarah Hess as, like, his...
Yes.
Like, he says in this interview, I think, that him and Sarah together probably wrote about 85% of the season. And so he's not being, like... I don't know, again, not shying away from the fact that, like, she's receiving this feedback, but instead going straight to the heart of it and being, like, I back up every single thing that she said. I don't think that she's misconstruing anything. We wrote this season together, and we think that we did a great job. And I would agree with them.
Agreed completely. I mean, and honestly, this goes to the point I was making like 15 minutes ago about like, people are like, oh yeah, Sarah Hess, she doesn't understand the character. It's like, why are you trying to like put Sarah Hess in a lower position than Ryan? They're clearly like partners, you know, they're clearly like working together and collaborating on this thing. You know, like there's been a lot of anger and hatred against Sarah Hess over the course of the last couple weeks, completely undeserved and nonsensical, honestly, just like nonsense.
Yeah.
It bothers me that fandom has like become like, again, us versus them. We need to pit people against each other. Only by me winning, well, only by you losing can I win, basically, is kind of how I see a lot of this attitude going. Anyway, all right. Jason from Boulder, Colorado writes into acastofkings@gmail.com. And he wrote in a few things. First of all, he wanted to celebrate Emma Darcy, who identifies as non-binary and uses they, them pronouns. They're absolutely incredible, and hopefully this will lead to more non-binary representation. Jason also wanted to give a shout out to the TikTok videos. Love videos of giving Kim Renfro giving amazing explanations with the piano playing in the background and clips from the show playing. It's really lovely and fun to watch. Side note from Dave Chen, hey, go to TikTok.com/@AcastaKings if you want to find more of those videos.
Mm-hmm.
And question for Kim Renfro. Will season two cover everything that is left of Fire and Blood? And if so, does that mean the show will be done after two seasons? End quote. Now, we've already discussed that George R.R. Martin says that has said that it will probably take around four seasons to complete the Fire and Blood story. Kim Renfro, roughly how far into the Fire and Blood book are we at this point in time? Do you know like
about halfway?
About halfway. Wow. So
and it
the next,
started yeah. like it's like we've done like the, I shouldn't do visuals on a podcast. I was trying to hold up my hands for yeah. that much, but it's like we've covered like 100 pages, maybe. Uh-huh. Maybe not even that, maybe like 75 pages of Fire and Blood. And I don't know exactly what the page count is, but I think it's somewhere around 300 to 400. So yeah, we're just about at the halfway point of Fire and Blood. And this is probably a good time. Other people have like DM'd me, I think, or tweeted at me asking if they wanted to read Fire and Blood now that season one is done, like what pages they should do. I can try and get a little bit more granular with that, but I will say it's hard to tell someone which sections to read that won't include any spoilers for like future references because of the nature of the book. They kind of hop around a lot. And there are things that happen in the finale where like they just decided to leave. Like it's all mixed up in those pages, what happens between Luke and Aemond, but what's going on with Jace and his like dragon messenger thing is all sort of like mixed up in that section, and they've saved that for season two. So I would say if you're truly trying to not be spoiled, I would hold off on reading Fire and Blood probably until the season's over, and then you could probably safely read like the first half. But to Jason's question, season two is not going to cover everything left of Fire and Blood. We still have Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna ask, for people who don't mind being slightly spoiled, do you have a sense of what people should read?
I'm sorry, I didn't prep the page numbers in front of me. I can tweet about it, or I'll post a comment on our decoding. Our decoding.
Yeah, how about this? Send out a tweet about it after we record this, and you can retweet it. Okay, I'll link to the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. But it would be roughly the first half. If you want to start with Aegon's conquest and get like the precursor all the way up to where we are, you're going to be reading about half the book. Also, I will say, love George R. R. Martin. It's kind of a dense and slightly snoozy read at points because you're really just getting a ton of names without a lot of characterization attached to them. A lot of just like reference. It's not as engaging as A Song of Ice and Fire was to me, because that's like a full novel experience. You're getting all these character perspectives. So if you attempt to go read Fire and Blood and you're like, yeesh, I don't think I can make it through 400 pages of that, that's fine. That's why I'm here. I will continue to do that for you. George said that he thinks four seasons of 10 episodes would do it. I did see, I think it might have been in that EW interview or maybe this New York Times one where Ryan Condal was like, oh, I actually haven't talked that granularly with him yet about like exactly how many seasons we're going to try and aim for. But given that they are not doing any more time jumps and that they're doing this in real time, I would expect season two to cover like, I don't know, probably not a ton in terms of page length, let's put it that way. I think that they're going to really slow down now and give you more of like the day-to-day events of what's going on in the Civil War as it escalates.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Kim Renfro, you wrote an article at insider.com about questions that you hope are resolved in season two, or open questions that this season left dangling. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we need to run down every single one of these, but I guess what would be the major ones for you, in your opinion? What are the biggest things where you're like, wow, we never got back to that topic, right?
Yeah. First and foremost, I really want to see where Lord Commander Westerling got to. We haven't seen him since like the start of episode 9 when he
like stormed out of the small council, right?
He was just like, I'm not here. Like, I have no business here until there's a new king or queen, and left after being asked to go assassinate Rhaenyra and her children, basically. So he, because he was once Rhaenyra's sworn protector, we saw him in the pilot, we've talked about this, like, I think that he could be a really significant ally to her, but the show has sort of left it open-ended as to where he might wind up. I don't know if we're going to get, like, a Barristan Selmy situation, you know, in Game of Thrones, how he, like, left the Kingsguard when Joffrey was crowned and then popped up a few seasons later to help Daenerys. So I'm very curious to see where they go with that. I also, as I was rewatching my episodes, and I saw one person tweet about this, I'm so sorry, I can't remember who it was, but, like, they might have swapped the Lannister twins, and I don't know if that was, like, either they're hinting at that because it's going to be some sort of, like, plot line in season two, maybe, but, like...
Well, when you say they swapped, so there's Tyland and Jason.
Yes.
Right? And Tyland is in the Small Council, and they're played by the same actor, right?
Played by the same actor. And Jason Lannister is the one who's, like, a little bit more of a buffoon. Like, yes. We met him in the stag... Like, we met both of them in that stag hunt episode.
Yes.
But Jason was the one, like, trying to have a serious conversation with Viserys about the Stepstones. And then Jason was, like, drinking wine and running his mouth to Rhaenyra.
Sorry, Tyland was the first one.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Tyland is supposed to be, like, the serious, I'm involved in politics, I need to talk to the king guy. Jason Lannister is, like, the one who just sort of ran his mouth about wanting Rhaenyra to be his lady wife, and he gave Viserys the spear and was all very, like, ceremonial. And then I was watching, like, I was rewatching the later episodes, and the Lannister who's on the Small Council in episode 9, who, like, again is sort of like, oh, now we can enact our long laid plans, was giving me way more Jason vibes than Tyland.
Okay.
And I was like, and then I saw someone else tweet about this, but it almost seems like they've, like, made it so that Jason is secretly on the Small Council instead of Tyland Lannister.
I think that's a bit of a stretch, you know, in my opinion, but...
It might be. It was just a weird...
you are correct that when I saw Tyland speak, I'm like, yes, that sounds a lot like Jason. But I just think my conclusion, honestly, Kim, is that they're both assholes. Like,
sure.
They're just both assholes. They're both of that kind, that type of guy.
That type of Lannister.
And, yeah, they're twins. You know, it's not like it's not unreasonable that they both have like some similar personality characteristics or ways of talking. So
you're right.
Yeah.
Who knows? But that was a thought that I had.
Also, I don't believe this theory at all, because also, like, if there was some nefarious thing going on to switch them. Wouldn't Jason want to act more like Tyland anyway? Okay.
Sure. But he's a big dummy.
Jason want to not make it obvious that he's Tyland? But again, 10 years have passed since the last time we saw, you know.
That is also true.
Jason Tyland. So maybe he's become more of a dick during that time.
That is also true.
All right. What other... So yeah, I agree. Where did Harold Westerling go? I'm very curious, like, where he's going to end up. What other major mysteries, you know, I will say I'm bummed we didn't get a check back in with Alicent last episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's going on with Alicent and, what's going, you know, what happened there. And, my understanding is, like, Missaria this past season had, like, a much smaller role than in the books. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I really would expect they sort of left that whole burning of her house thing just there, and I do not believe for a second that she's actually dead. So I'm
really,
like,
I think sure you don't see her die, but the strong implication is that she's dead. But I would agree that it is not a certain thing. So
yeah, I kind of I generally subscribe to the no body,
yes,
no crime, yes, rule of television. So, like,
yeah.
And the fact that they, like, made it impossible to see who it was walking away from her house, like, maybe it's just supposed to be some anonymous Larys.
Right, right.
Fire
again,
person.
That was my interpretation. It was like Larys' person walking away, but it could have been Missaria herself or someone else, right?
Yeah, so I'm waiting for that thread to pick back up again for sure. And then I was, again, on my rewatch, like, Alicent has an older brother, Gawain Hightower, who was a knight. Daemon, like, beat the crap out of him in the tournament, mm-hmm, in the pilot episode. I'm wondering if they're going to bring more... like, him, as well as Alicent and Viserys' fourth child, Daeron. Maybe they will both re-enter the story together, having both been at Old Town this whole time. Also, if we see... I kind of want to see Old Town. I don't know if you remember from Game of Thrones days, but Old Town was like one of their cooler locations that we got introduced to in the later seasons, with like the big tower, that huge library that Sam goes into. Old Town is a neat location. So I wonder if we're going to actually visit there and get a checkup on Allison's older brother, who is presumably important to the Hightower cause, as well as her youngest son, Darren.
There were a bunch of questions, actually, we got about Rhaena as well, which is also listed in your article, right?
Yeah.
So Rhaena is Daemon and Lena's daughter, right?
Nailed it. Yep.
Phew. And in episode 6, she has not claimed a dragon yet. Is she the one that was supposed to get the one that Aemond ended up claiming, or?
Yeah, I mean, supposed to. I've had people critique me for saying so on Twitter. There's no like rule that the child of a dragon rider is supposed to inherit that dragon. But yes, in the episode where Aemond claimed Vhagar, Rhaena was the one who kind of like ran out and was like, hey, that was supposed to be like, that was my mother's dragon. That was supposed to be my dragon. But she had clearly not attempted to claim her yet. So yeah, Rhaena still doesn't have a dragon.
I think there was a lot of questions as to why, like, I don't know. I don't remember how many years have passed since episode 6, but like some, right?
At least 3.
I
want
to
say.
Like, why in all the time since episode 6 to episode 10, why has not Rhaena claimed a dragon yet? Because there's dragons, you know, there's unclaimed dragons flying around. You know, like, why Rhaena no dragon yet, basically, is a question I've seen. Right?
Yeah, I mean, she was carrying an egg with her for a long time, hoping that her egg would, like, that an egg that she had in her crib and everything would hatch. And we see Lena, before she died, have this conversation with Rhaena saying, like, you know, not all of them do. Like, it's sort of a mystery as to why some of the eggs that are placed with Targaryen babies in their cribs, like, do hatch and become that person's bonded dragon. Sometimes they don't. So Rhaena so far has been in the no egg hatching camp. And I think that maybe she was, like, waiting a while for the egg theory to work, because that's certainly a less risky way to get a dragon than trying to just claim one. It's not always a guaranteed success that you're going to face down a giant dragon and not die instead of getting a claim from one. So I don't know if there, I'm also waiting to see if Rhaena gets her dragon. It also makes, I was also like, just in general, I really hope that they give both Rhaena and Baela some more lines in season 2. They were mostly like pretty quiet characters who were just sort of there for most of the pilot episode and didn't talk a ton. But I'm very curious to see how they feel about this impending war, how they want to or don't want to support Rhaenyra. They both seem to be very happy in their place in her court. But Rhaena especially, because now her fiancé was just killed by her own mom's former dragon that Aemond was riding. Like, that's doubly sad, I think, for her. So now Rhaena is fiance-less and dragonless. Hopefully she gets a little come up in season 2.
Hopefully it's smooth sailing for Rhaena from this point forward.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. So, okay, let me just throw an email into the mix here.
Great.
Info. Castkings@gmail.com. Jordan from Charlotte, North Carolina writes, and this is just a part of the email. Firstly, Jordan celebrates the fact that there's so many women at the council table in Dragonstone. That's great. They're still outnumbered by men, but it's nice to see them there. And Rhaenyra may not be perfect, but at least she understands her role as queen doesn't include slaughtering thousands just so she can sit on the Iron Throne, end quote. But I really liked what Jordan wrote here, where she says, quote, why is every man on this show so bad at grieving? Don't answer that. I know toxic masculinity ruins the party again and gender norms are stupid, but it is incredibly telling that 3 of the main male characters on the show, when faced with intense loss, run away from it towards violence rather than face their emotions and remain at home to support the ones they love. Daemon, Corlys, and Laenor, although he claimed he is going to stay with Rhaenyra before the shenanigans of the final few episodes, should form a bad husband's guild and immediately enroll in some intense group therapy. End quote.
I would add Viserys to that mix.
I was actually surprised at the list of names there.
Right.
Viserys is probably the one that I would really add on there.
Yeah.
But yes, I think what the message of the show is trying to say is if men were more in touch with their feelings, fewer people would die. Right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, that's kind of what the takeaway is. But anyway, any other thoughts on that topic or this season of the show, or you know, as we send folks off to next season? I do want to mention, of course, that Cast of Kings is a Decoding TV podcast, and we will be covering other shows throughout the year, including very likely with Kim Renfro, over at podcast.decodingtv.com. So be sure to subscribe to make sure you get more of those. But yeah, Kim, any other thoughts on the season as we wrap up for another 18 months, probably?
Oh, God, isn't that wild? But then I feel like we're going to be here in 2024 being like, the last year has flown by. I hope it goes by fast.
Yeah. Good impression of us, by the way.
Thank you.
But yeah, I we will be recording bonus episodes throughout the year when a piece of news drops, you know? So
yeah, I'm excited for casting news for some characters like Cregan Stark. We know we're going to be meeting next season because we know that Jace is headed to Winterfell. So yeah, I think it'll be fun kind of like watching the new casting announcements roll out. Hopefully other spinoff / prequel / sequel / successor show news to come. Now that they've seen how this will be a success, I kind of expect HBO to possibly move one of those in development ideas into either like a pilot stage or maybe a series order. So yeah, just sort of stay in tune. George says he's 75% done with the Winds of Winter. So who knows? Maybe we'll be sitting here in 2024 with Winds of Winter content to talk about, but I've been deeply wrong about that before, so don't hold me to that timeline. George doesn't have a timeline. He's just working on it, he says, people. So let the man write at his pace, I suppose. That's all there we can do.
There has been some suggestions that we try to cover some parts of the book, Kim. I don't know if I probably should have saved this for our off air conversation.
Some parts of the A Song of Ice and Fire books?
No.
Fire and Blood.
For instance, like read Fire and Blood and like talk about the chapters in Fire and Blood, for instance.
I would do that with you, like especially for the sections where they like
for the stuff we've already done, basically.
They made big changes or something. Have you read those and respond to that? That would be fun. I just had something else that I thought of. Oh, I guess last wrap-up thought I was going to leave people with. I know I keep mentioning that I rewatched all the episodes recently, but I really, like, if you really loved the show and are sad to see it go, I honestly can't recommend a rewatch more of this first season. Now, mm-hmm. now that you will know where the time jumps are going to happen, now that you know where they land the finale, I was really impressed. Like, I liked the pilot episode when I first watched it. Rewatching it, I was like, damn, there is like almost not a single piece of dialogue that goes
it's paid off. Everything's paid off.
I feel like they were very economic about their decisions, but in a way that was not giving away the game early on. I really became more impressed with the writing as I was rewatching and just seeing how they were able to like lay these foundations, lay these like little tidbits that pay off later. Just really, I love when a show only feels enriched upon a rewatch. And so if you're even thinking about doing that, I fully endorse
Are there any specific examples from like the early episodes that you were like, oh wow, that was incredible? Like where you're like, I can't believe they put that in. They knew where they were going, you know?
I think like the Corlys stuff, especially like the way that Corlys is operating at the small council table with Viserys and like all of that, just like obviously he goes up and down and back and forth between being loyal to Rhaenyra, but knowing that in the end he is going to swear to Rhaenyra's cause. You can see all of that political strategy already being laid in the small council meeting, the way that he interacts with Rhaenyra. Rhaenyra and Daemon's entire relationship, it feels very pointed with the way that they were having them interact pretty early on. Mm-hmm. Harold Westerling, like I said, like I remember in that first episode being like, oh yeah, they have this like random Kingsguard here. But then it's like, oh, if you know that 20 years down the line, he's going to be ordered to go kill Rhaenyra, seeing the way that he's interacting with mm-hmm. her and like protecting her in that pilot episode makes a lot of sense. Every single one of the tournaments, watching Daemon and Kristen Cole go at it on like the tournament field, knowing where both of their characters are going to wind up on Team Green and Team Black is honestly kind of fun.
It looks like they haven't aged a day since then, you know?
One of the Baratheon who's participating in the tournament, when he asks for Rhaenys's favor, he calls her the queen that never was.
Right.
And Otto Hightower like leans over to Viserys and says, you could have his tongue for that. And I was like, damn, we went from like, oh, even the slightest mention of Rhaenys being considered once for Queen of the Iron Throne is like rip out your tongue worthy to like Vaemond screaming in the throne room saying like, she's a whore and her children are bastards and getting his head cut off. It was like, oh yeah, that's why. Like, it is that serious if somebody like even implies that like the current king should not be legitimate or like should not be be respected or whatever. I'm sure I could think of more, but yeah, it just felt great to sort of rewatch everything knowing where it goes without that anticipation of like, oh, is this going to be a good or a bad episode? But like, just got, you never know.
Yes.
But rewatching them, I honestly have
Didn't you though, Kim?
What? Oh, how I just love every episode.
Yeah, there's a comment. Somebody was like, you know, Kim stole her tagline from McDonald's. I'm loving it every single time. You know?
Yeah, I know.
It sounds like I'm making fun of you, but it was a delight. It was a delight to experience your joy of the show with you. You know?
Thanks.
So I wasn't. It's not a criticism.
No, I know. I did. I was ready for it every weekend. I was like, well, Dave, I loved it. What can I say? Also, one right. more. Zelda has joined us for the.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, now you're in the way. Anyways.
All right. Well,
this was a delight.
I think that'll probably do it for us here today on the podcast. Hopefully, you've enjoyed hearing us reflect on the season and talk about some of the stuff that's come out since then. And if major Game of Thrones news or House of the Dragon news drops, we will probably be here. So keep subscribed to Cast of Kings. We'll be back to talk about whatever is coming next. But I just want to again thank our listeners this season for tuning back in. It was not a sure thing that people would return, given the, you know, a lot of people, when a host change happens, people don't necessarily tune back in. We're grateful for everyone that's decided to stick around. And obviously, of course, grateful to you, Kim, for joining me on this journey. It has really greatly enriched my last few months, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way.
Totally. Right back at you.
All right. Until next time, be well. Be safe. We'll see you for the next bit of Game of Thrones news that hits. Goodbye.
Bye.